for Antiwar.com and Chaos Radio 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas. I'm Scott Horton. This is Anti-War Radio. Scott Horton, every day, 11 to 1 Texas time, here on Chaos Radio. Websites, antiwar.com, Chaos Radio 95, chaos959.com. That's K-A-O-S-959.com. My blog is thestressblog.com. All my archives are at scotthortonshow.com. The whole anti-war project, anti-war radio project, is at antiwar.com/radio. Although that's not really ready for primetime yet, you should just go to antiwar.com and click on the anti-war radio section there at the top right-hand side of the page. LibertyStickers.com, anti-war, anti-government propaganda for the back of your car. And join my MySpace thing if you want. MySpace.com/Scott_Horton. Horton. People always say, wait, what'd you say? Like, I can't even pronounce my own last name right. Maybe I can't. Sounds right in my own ears sometimes, most of the time. Anyway, Horton, you know, like, here's a coup. Anyway, so yeah, it's anti-war radio on Chaos 959 in Austin, Texas. And, wow, headlines today. Check this out. My eyebrows are raised. Germany holds three over alleged plots. And I saw this headline. I have to admit, first impression, no facts here, just the headline. First thing I thought was, wow, real terrorist plot? Huh. First of all, seems more likely that actual jihadists willing and able to kill Americans would be able to get to Europe than here. And secondly, my gut tells me that the, you know, and I have no way of knowing this at all, but I just, you know, just my assumption, you know, from the ether. The German police, I'm thinking, probably have a longer time preference than the FBI. The FBI doesn't really think about the future so much. They think about tonight's headlines. Ladies and gentlemen, a massive terrorism plot has been uncovered in Virginia, New York, Miami, Lodi, California, New Jersey, and on. Oh my goodness, they say. Massive terrorist plot. And then, of course, later, they're embarrassed when these massive terrorist plots turn out to be basically nothing. Something tells me that the behavior among the police in Germany is probably a little bit more adult than the FBI. I'd be surprised if they were willing to come out with a bunch of hype about a terrorist case if there wasn't, you know, if they weren't at least really convinced that they had something here. But again, that's only my first impression. I have to say, after reading the first few paragraphs of this article, which is all I've read of it so far, out of a good 2 pages and then some. Well, actually, no, I guess that's not right. I guess I read at least the first page of this. I guess I didn't finish it, though. Got all the way to the arrest in Denmark, so yeah. This seemed like a plausible scenario. Berlin, this is from MSNBC.com. Three suspected Islamic terrorists from an Al-Qaeda-influenced group nursing profound hatred of U.S. citizens, that's in quotes, were arrested on suspicion of plotting imminent massive bomb attacks on U.S. facilities in Germany, prosecutors said Wednesday. German federal prosecutor Monica Harms said the three, two of whom were German converts to Islam, had trained at camps in Pakistan run by the Islamic Jihad Union. Oh, great. Commie jihadists. A group based in Central Asia. They had obtained some 1,500 pounds of hydrogen peroxide for making explosives, it says. We were able to succeed in recognizing and preventing the most serious and massive bombings, Harms told reporters. She declined to name specific targets, but said the suspects had an eye on institutions and establishments frequented by Americans in Germany, including discos, pubs, and airports. Police sources told NBC News that U.S. military installations such as Ramstein Air Base and soft targets such as nightclubs visited by American service personnel as well as German airports were potential targets, but no specific locations had been identified. Now, it does say in here that they began watching these guys when they were observed, here it says, they first came to the attention of authorities because they had been caught observing a U.S. military facility in Hanau near Frankfurt at the end of 2006. So, at least it is being claimed. Don't want to give a government agency the benefit of the doubt against an individual. But it is alleged that these guys first were monitored when they were checking out an army base. And that was when the German police started following them around. And apparently they were trying to arrange some explosives and so forth. So we'll try to keep our eyes on this. I don't know who the hell we is. I'm Scott and I got two eyeballs. But I'll try my best to keep my eye on this and see whether this this really is an actual plot that's been thwarted by the German police here or not. Let's hope they don't just turn them over to the American military to go off to a secret prison somewhere. And, you know, I think there's an important point here in that there actually are people who hate America enough to kill themselves in order to kill Americans. There are people who hate the United States enough to want to carry out attacks like this. And in fact, I wanted to find this this one more quote in here if I can scan through it real quick about the motivation of this. You know, here it says this group distinguishes itself through its profound hatred of U.S. citizens. And then this paragraph I think is all important here on the second page. Germany, which did not send troops to Iraq, has been spared terrorist attacks like the train and subway bombings in Madrid and London, although its involvement in the attempt to stabilize Afghanistan has led to fears it might be targeted. Okay, that's where they're over there in Germany, and they never try to tell people, oh, well, the terrorists attacked America because they hate America's freedom. That was never a lie told there that had to be discounted. They understand in Europe, I guess, seems like. I hate to talk about the Europeans like they're the grown-ups and we're the kids, but that is the way it seems, isn't it? They understand good and well what causes suicide terrorism, occupation, foreign interventionism. They'd been spared bombings since they didn't participate in Iraq. Weren't the ones bombing the no-fly zones and occupying Saudi Arabia pre-9/11. And after 9/11, they didn't help us to invade Iraq. So, in Germany over there, they went, phew, and wiped their foreheads and said, great. You know, hopefully we won't be targets. But then their government went and chipped in Afghanistan. And their minimal presence as, you know, peacekeepers and reconstructors and so forth in Afghanistan, of course, have turned into supporting an occupation and a war in Afghanistan over the long term. And so now they recognize over there in Germany, well, now that we're meddling in the Islamic world in America's terror war, now we recognize that we may be subject to attack. And I would say to them, yeah, good thinking. I think you figured it out. This is Chaos Radio 95.9 Austin. my friends. Welcome back to Anti-War Radio on Chaos Radio 95.9 in Austin, Texas. I'm Scott Horton, and our first guest today is Eric Bollert from Media Matters for America. Welcome to the show, sir.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, well, I saw this this great piece that I got in my email box this morning about news coverage of the war, and I admit I'm spoiled rotten. I read antiwar.com every day. I got all the news from every newspaper in the world that matters about anything, and I forget sometimes what it's like to be the average American who relies on TV to tell them what's going on in the world, you know, 10 minutes here and 10 minutes there and so forth. And you guys do a really good job at Media Matters, and I don't always agree, but I do always appreciate your work. And you really go through and break down all the statistics for us. And you, well, in your article today, you've got links to four or five different polls and four or five different studies by different universities and so forth, backing up, counting the coverage for you and comparing that to people's attitudes and so forth. And it's a great piece of work, and it's a great example of the kind of work that you guys do at Media Matters, I think.
Thanks, I appreciate it. And you mentioned the 10 minutes. That's probably being generous to the you know, the bits and pieces of television news coverage we've seen from Iraq. I mean, you know, the headline of the piece is the Iraq news blackout, how the press spent its summer vacation.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really amazing. And what I stumbled across were two separate surveys that are done in conjunction with each other. One is from the Project for Excellence in Journalism, and the other is the Pew Research. And every week, Pew Research polls 1,000 adults and asks them, what is the news story they followed most closely the previous week? And the Project for Excellence in Journalism monitors on a weekly basis, has this ongoing study, 48 major media outlets, radio, TV, network, cable, newspapers, and it documents exactly how much space editors and producers give each story. So it's a great way to tell what Americans are paying attention to and what the media is paying attention to.
Uh-huh. I'm reminded of a Henry Kissinger quote, actually, where he said he watches the news every night, but with the volume off. He doesn't care what they're saying, but what matters is how much time they spend on each subject and
That's
in
right.
which order they run.
Yeah, and television really is king in terms of, you know, communicating with Americans. But if you look at the studies, the disconnect between the amount of attention Americans are paying to the situation in Iraq, meaning reporting on the ground from Iraq, and the amount of coverage the press is giving it is sort of mind-boggling. And in the column I go through every week of the summer, and on average during the summer, the situation in Iraq, that was one of the news categories, was far and away the most popular, the most closely watched news event of the summer, week after week after week. And on average for the summer, 31% of Americans said they followed the situation from Iraq very closely. The amount of news coverage it got week after week, the situation in Iraq represented 4.5% of all the news coverage. And if it wasn't for the more aggressive coverage in newspapers online, that number would have been even lower, because cable and network news, you know, all essentially boycotted Iraq during the summer. And here we are with Americans week after week saying it's the most important story. It's this, not really the most important, because that's a slightly different answer. It's the story they're following the most closely.
Right.
And the press couldn't care less at this point. And I write about how Iraq fatigue, the difference is how it affects Americans and how it affects newsrooms. It hasn't affected most Americans. They're almost just as interested today as they were 4 years ago.
Well, is it just
boredom? But in newsrooms, they have just walked away from the whole thing.
Why have they just walked away? I mean, you mentioned the costs of security. I mean, obviously they can't. It's hard to leave the green zone. Patrick Coburn's got the courage to go riding around in the back of a taxi, but not too many of these guys do, and I can understand that.
Yeah.
I don't want to go, you know, trolling around Iraq in a car and get my head cut off either. But
but
at the same time, I mean, hell, they could at least stand on the porch in the green zone and look out and tell us something, right?
That's right. We don't even see the and I'm the last one, you know, question the courage of any of the reporters. The fact that they're there is, I think, is testament to their professionalism and wanting to be at the center of the action. But you're right, we don't even see sort of the rooftop reports from the green zone anymore. It's been difficult and expensive and deadly to cover Iraq for years now, but that really doesn't explain the precipitous drop we've seen this summer. And the irony is, I let off the column, I noted, you know, Katie Couric is in Iraq and reporting from Baghdad, and she said she went over there because she wanted to get more context. She wanted to get, you know, a better sense of what was going on. And my point is, well, you know, if CBS had simply reported the story all summer, she wouldn't have had to travel 8,000 miles to figure out what was going on in Iraq.
Yeah, that's just the fact that Katie Couric is a news person. I don't know. I haven't watched the nightly news on the broadcast channels, the, you know, ABC, CBS, NBC. I haven't watched those newscasts in so long. I'm disconnected. But the idea that Americans are turning to Katie Couric to do hard news at night, wasn't that Dan Rather's? Is she in Dan Rather's chair or Brokaw's or one of those?
Dan Rather, right, yeah.
Oh, man. Well, okay.
I don't
want to go too far down that rabbit trail.
Right.
That could lead to all kinds of nightmares. But you know, see, here's the thing, though, Eric. I'm a real free market kind of guy.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a plumb line libertarian.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me like the free market is demanding Iraq coverage. Why aren't we getting it?
Well, it's interesting. You know, and as I point out in my piece, I said, you know, I mean, journalism is a public service, but it's also a business. So, you know, editors and producers are always trying to match up what they cover with what people are interested in. I mean, you'd be a fool to devote all your time and resources consistently to stories the research shows news consumers have no interest in. I mean, there has to be a cross-section. But here we're seeing the exact opposite. I mean, we're seeing news consumers telling pollsters week after week after week the most important news story in Iraq, and we have the mainstream press just walking away from it. So the question is, you're right, why is that happening? Well, as I mentioned, there's a lot more news from Iraq online and in newspapers, and I think if you focus on online, I think it's just another example of why more and more people are getting their news online. It seems to be, in this specific case, it seems to be a better reflection in terms of what people want and what they're getting. And they're finding it online. For whatever reason, the news people in charge of the sites that are being monitored online are doing a better job there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, and maybe the TV people realize, well, the people who actually want real news are now reading it, and so we're only left with the audience that wants to hear about the gay Republican senator or whatever.
Well, that might be, but again, I mean, this story is Iraq has been such an important story for so long. It's sort of amazing that, you know, particularly television producers have came to this decision this summer that they're just not going to cover it. I mean, for a quarter, in the second quarter, MSNBC, for instance, I mean, devoted 1.5% of its entire news coverage to events in Iraq. And the amazing thing is, you know, there's all this hype about the Petraeus report coming up.
Right.
And there's obviously going to be a heated debate in Washington about, you know, troop levels and America's continued presence in Iraq. And how are Americans supposed to make informed decisions about our future in Iraq if we can't even get news coverage?
Right.
If you look at these polls, they're begging for more news coverage from Iraq.
Right.
And they're,
know,
just not getting it from the mainstream press. And as you mentioned, I think it's another reason that people are sort of slowly but steadily walking away from the mainstream press as their number one news source.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, the amount of coverage that there actually is mostly a bunch of ridiculous hype anyway. I mean, I've been hearing for, you know, 2 or 3 months that the liberal media just won't report it, but the surge is going well. And
right.
And yet that's all I hear from anybody.
Right. And we're only going to see more of that as, you know, the hype of the report comes up.
Yeah.
I mean, that certainly is the conservative talking point.
Yeah,
that the press won't.
Liberal one. I mean, this is what I see on you know, basically every news source. And you know, it's funny. I'm sorry. I just want to pick on MSNBC here since you mentioned them. I'm sure that you're aware. You'll remember exactly what I'm talking about. There's this clip that they play as their stock news footage of the Iraq War on MSNBC that they've been playing for years now. And I as far as I can tell, I believe it's from the original invasion. And it's a picture of a tank round. It's actually a few few different clips, but the one that's the most memorable is, I guess, a tank round or something hitting this kind of pale red building, and the whole building is just kind of destroyed and collapses in and so forth. And it's a very old-looking structure. And, you know, they don't even have new pictures of things exploding to show us at all. Like, they don't even have a cameraman on the ground. I'm going to sit here, and as Chris Matthews or whoever it is spending his, you know, 1 minute per show on Iraq.
Right.
And I'm going to sit here, and I'm going to watch this same building get shot by this same tank round that I've been watching for years.
For 4.5 years. Well, you know, they just don't, they literally can't even cover most of the country. And you know, I referenced that. If folks remember, on August 14th, there were the 5 synchronized suicide bombers in northern Iraq by the Syrian border that killed over 500 people.
Mm-hmm. The attack on the Yazidis.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And they just, obviously, they could only send stringers up there because no American journalist could survive a trip up to the border and back. And it was the 500 people, more than 500 people were killed. It was the second deadliest terror strike ever. Only behind 9/11 were more civilians killed in a terrorist attack.
Wow.
And the next night, it wasn't even the lead story on NBC Nightly News. It was on page 6, the New York Times, page 6 of the Washington Post. And, I mean, if that, you know, if a sort of a historic, monstrous act of destruction like that, you know, won't wake the press from its slumber, you know, I'm not sure what will.
Yeah, but see, okay, here we got to get back to this thing about the boredom and the slumber and all that. And pardon me for being, I really don't mean to lean conspiracy kook here, but I kind of imagine, you know, somebody in the White House or, you know, on the National Security Council or something making some phone calls to some newspaper editors and some TV producers and telling them, hey, look, we're working on this whole surge is working great thing and you're not going to screw it up for us, you understand? Or maybe not. Maybe more subtle than that. Just, you know, hey, this is what the White House wants. This is what the White House gets. It can't just be that all these reporters are this bored with the story. I mean, I have to tell you, I'm sick and tired of it myself, but
right.
That's not the same as bored.
Right,
and
right,
I still
right.
cover it every single day.
Right.
So, you know, I don't know. I guess the easy answer is, hey, they're all these reporters, they're all just individuals, and they can only do what they can do, and they're just not interested. But, you know, the way you lay it out in this article, where, you know, the casualty rates are going up this much, the interest in the news stories goes up this much, while the coverage is a perfect sine wave going the other direction.
Yeah, right.
You know, is it possible that there's something behind this?
Well, the only thing that I could think that the correlation would be is that the press, you know, there certainly are the talking points coming out of the White House that the surge is working and Republicans are making that case. You know, my only thought was that the press doesn't want to be caught, you know, on the wrong side of the story. They don't want to, much like they didn't want to be caught on the wrong side during the run-up to the war.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they don't want to wake up one day and suddenly, you know, obviously it's not going to happen. It doesn't happen overnight. All of a sudden, you know, the surge has been victorious and we won the war. They don't want to be out there being portrayed or seen as being negative because that liberal media bias charge still carries a lot of weight. I don't know if that's why it's happening, but, you know, there is a political element here, and the political element is, you know, the surge is working and the press isn't reporting all the good news. I mean, we've heard that mantra literally since March 2003.
Absolutely, all the way through. The funny thing is, though, I guess that kind of leads to a separate question, which is the ignorance of these reporters. I mean, I'm here to tell you that anybody who says the surge is working is on the wrong side of the story. You know, the fact that they recruited the Sunni insurgency to fight al-Qaeda when they were had already turned on al-Qaeda, and that all they're doing really is arming the Sunni groups who still refuse to submit to Maliki's government, and training them just guarantees more bloodshed later and more fighting later on. This surge is a joke. This is a temporary thing. It's just another one of these, 6 month turning point things that we're just supposed to hang on 6 more months and 6 more months and 6 more months forever. Anybody who in the press, who's actually a reporter, who's supposed to be covering this story, who's worried that they might be on the wrong side of it, if they don't report it, that everything's hunky-dory is a fool and shouldn't be reporting on this in the first place.
Well, the good news is the reporters who are actually in Iraq, you know, when they're on TV and, you know, in the major newspapers, I think they do a pretty good job of giving a clear picture, you know, as they see it. The problem is, particularly on TV, they're simply not on. I mean, the reports are simply not aired. I mean, if MSNBC devoted 1.5% of its news hole to Iraq, so I think I trust the people on the ground. I've always trusted the reporters on the ground almost since day one. But the problem we're having now is their editors and producers back in New York and Washington simply won't put them on the air. I mean, they simply will not report Iraq as a substantial news story. That now, what's different is they love reporting about, you know, Iraq policy. They'll report the you know, the Beltway debate,
right?
You know, the who's up, who's down. Do Democrats have? That's what they love. That's just old-fashioned horse race politics.
Right.
And they'll spend all the time they need. It's easy. It's simple. Doesn't cost any money. You can get the talking heads. It's all about politics.
Right.
That's separate. That the press has covered ad nauseum. I don't think it's been very nuanced or insightful, but they've spent a lot of time doing that because, as I said, it's easy. The war reporting is a completely different story, and that is where the press has really walked away from it.
Yeah, and, you know, it's funny. I think of, like, a guy like Chris Matthews. He was an aide to Tip O'Neill, right?
Right,
I mean, that's where a lot of these guys come from, is they are the kind of rubber meets the road electoral politics kind of people in
right,
the first
place. Right,
that's
what really gets them excited.
Yeah, and so, yeah, to them, that's everything, is Obama said this, and then Hillary said that back.
Right,
what do you make of it? We got four guests on this hour to talk about the back and forth between Hillary and Obama, and
right.
And you're right, that is, I don't know why that's easier. I'd have more trouble trying to keep track of that stuff.
But you just sit around and sort of jabber. You don't have to leave your studio, and it's simple and it's easy and it's inexpensive. Covering a war is a whole other story, and that's where the disconnect has come. And if you look at these surveys that I cite in my article, in terms of viewer interest, not nearly as interested in the Beltway debate about the war. It doesn't rank nearly as high. Americans have been consistent through the whole summer that they're interested specifically in the situation in Iraq. They don't really care about the wrangling in the Beltway. That's not a story that interests them. What's happening with the troops in Iraq is far away the most important story to news consumers, and it's a story that the press, particularly TV, you know, all but boycotted all summer.
I like how in your article here you list some other topics that Nightline covered instead of the war: the popularity of organic pet food, the favorite songs of Pete Wentz, bassist for Fall Out Boy, the folding of supermarket tabloid The Weekly World News, oh man, the rise of urban McMansions, the death of the postcard, the commercial battle between Barbie and Bratz dolls, and the nerd stars of the movie Superbad. That was on Nightline?
7 weeks. Last 7 weeks, Nightline has aired. You know, they do three segments now, so they've done over 100 segments since mid-July, and they haven't done a single report about the situation in Baghdad. But as you said, those are some of the stories they did do during that seven-week stretch.
Yeah. You know, I'll tell you something. Somebody sent me a link the other day. I'm not sure if you saw this footage, but there was a protest up in Canada at some, you know, meeting of capitalists and bureaucrats or something, and the lefties were outside protesting. And there were three guys with the black masks and so forth dressed up like they were anarchists, but it was obvious that they were cops, that they were middle-aged, you know, weightlifting cops. They didn't look like skinny little anarchists at all, you know? And so everybody called them out, and you know, it was the cop who had the rock in his hand, and it was this big thing. Anyway, the point of the story is that somebody sent me a link to news coverage of this going on in Canada, and it was a national news network. I forget exactly, but it was a national news thing, and it was the top story of the show apparently, and they spent 15, 17, 20 minutes saying, you know, explaining, here's the footage, here's our reporter on the scene talking all about it, saying every single thing that there is to report about this case, having right. time to say every single thing he knows, questions and answers from the anchors back. And I thought, you know what, this reminds me of watching TV news in like 1982 or something. I can't believe, you know, wow, look, mainstream media spending 15 minutes on an important news story right. and actually trying on TV right. and actually trying to get every bit of information that they can, even if it makes the government look bad. And, you know, that to me was the most impressive thing. Of course, cops throw rocks and pretend to be anarchists. Who does anybody think starts all these riots? Of course it's them. You know, never mind that. The news story here is that there was a news story, a real right. honest to goodness news story about it.
Was this Canadian news?
Yeah, yeah,
that
Canadian news.
That was probably the CBC, yeah, which is great.
Yeah, I just, you know, I'm not sure. Yeah, it very well may have been the CBC. But yeah, I was shocked. And it was like watching the news 20 years ago or something.
Right, right.
I was
when
a
they took
kid.
A long time to do an important news story and weren't yeah. afraid of, being attacked for being liberal or whatever it is.
Right.
I mean, the press is just scared out of its wits and has been for, you know, the last 6 years.
Yeah, see, that's the part I can't understand, is what's to be scared of? So they're going to call
job.
You names, you know?
No, it's professional. It's careerism. It's your job. It's your
yeah.
career path.
Mm-hmm.
That's what, unfortunately, too many of these journalists sort of hold near and dear to their hearts. And they've seen, they're very smart people, and they see the career trajectory, and they understand what the pitfalls are, and you just, you know. That's why you write about John Edwards' haircut, and you sort of chuckle and laugh, and everyone sort of pats each other on the back because they're so savvy and sophisticated. And it's a boys' club, and you can make a very good living out of it. So that's what they're afraid of. That's the fear, not being called names or anything like that. It's how's it going to affect my career path?
Yeah, that's funny. I guess I've never really thought before of ranking media people, you know, news anchors in there with, on the list, you know, with magicians and stand-up comedians and TV actors and movie actors and whatever in their little rank of celebrity. I guess the TV news anchors fit in there somewhere, between magicians and comics.
Yeah, I mean, you were mentioning Katie Couric. I mean, in the last year since Katie Couric has been on at CBS,
it's been a year? Oh, man.
Yeah, I think it was a year this week. I mean, between the New York Times and the Washington Post, I guarantee they've written 50 articles.
Oh.
And she reads the news off the teleprompter for 22, not even 22. I mean, she's actually on camera about 8 minutes a night. I mean, it's the complete cult of personality. And I mean, it's a whole separate topic, but the press has become convinced that, you know, TV anchors are important, influential people that should be covered as if they're world leaders and politicians. I mean, it's a joke.
Yeah, they're their own news stories.
Yeah.
Like that. And what's funny, too, is, you know, when they really started the cable news channels, really first with CNN and then, of course, everybody racing to catch up, I thought, you know, the promise there was that we were going to finally have, you know, frontline-style documentaries and real investigative news reporting,
yeah.
you know, because now they have all the time in the world. But
all the time in the world, right. Unfortunately, you know, the cable producers view the world in 15-minute segments, because that's how you're rated. So you're right. I mean, the idea was, you know, 24 hours. Look at how are we going to fill all this time? Well, we'll fill it with interesting, innovative news.
Right.
And as we've seen, I mean, it's all just sort of copycat stuff.
And sometimes it really is investigative reporting.
Yep.
But then,
it makes you wonder why.
Right.
Why is it only three times a year when they have to fill up about 800 hours a year or
right.
whatever it is?
Or sometimes, you know, I'll be amazed to see how much work they'll put into telling the story of a murder that took place in some American city.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, they will really investigate and do a substantial report about
this guy
killed his wife, you know,
yeah.
and wanted some money or something. And, you know, like Bill Curtis on Investigative Reports on A&E, he used to actually cover real stories. Now it's
right.
all just true crime nonsense.
Right.
Yeah.
As if people have never killed each other in passion before. I know it's treated as wildly important, when unfortunately, it's pretty common in America these days.
Yep. All right. Well, so what would you do about it? I don't know. I'd buy out Rupert Murdoch with my my newfound treasure chest, and I'd put you in charge of I won't put you directly in charge of Fox News. That wouldn't be fair to the guys. But I'd put you in charge of, you know, parts of the media empire, and you want to make some changes, some systemic changes, some structural changes that that will guarantee that things are tilted more toward what's important. How do you do it? What do you want to? What changes would you make?
It's a tough business because, you know, people make changes and then the ratings, you know, dip 3% and everyone freaks out and runs back to the old formula. But, you know, the hope it would be that, A, you wouldn't play copycat, specifically you don't chase Fox. You know, you talked about libertarian and filling the marketplace. I mean, look at Keith Olbermann. I mean, his show is far and away the most successful cable news show in the last year. His audience is double.
Oh, really?
And Olbermann has mentioned a couple times. He's been shocked that no one has come after his audience, which is, you know, essentially you know, liberal and or progressive and anti-war. I mean, he's obviously made that a cornerstone of his show.
Mm-hmm.
The show has doubled; its ratings has doubled in the last year. No other show comes close, and no one, not one show, has tried to go after his market. And he's mentioned a couple times he's been shocked that no one has tried to, you know, sort of make a run at his territory. But for some reason, you know, if you have a progressive agenda and your show doubles, all these producers who normally are so quick to copycat just sort of look at it and say, no, well, no thanks. We're not interested in those rating gains.
Huh.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's really unusual because the cable news business is absolutely known for its copycat approach. And here's Olbermann with the most successful show, and no one's interested in copying it.
Right, and you know, it seems like if these executives want to keep their jobs, eventually denying their stockholders money they could be making is supposed to, you know, have some backlash there.
Maybe instead, not. You know, CNN continues to carry, right-wing talk show hosts like Glenn Beck, whose ratings have been on decline all year. I mean, some nights, he gets like 50,000 viewers in his demo, you know, and this is a country of 300 million.
Yeah,
I mean, he's an absolute dead weight for CNN. But, you know, he's been on a year and a half, and there's no indication they're going to drop him, even though he's a ratings bust.
Huh.
So there seems to be a pretty clear double standard.
Yeah, sure sounds like it. And, I don't know. I guess if you want, we got a little bit more time. If you want to get into the presidential campaign a bit, I've noticed, and you know, to be fair, I understand. And, you know, you have to kind of be in the polls to be in the polls and to get covered. And once you get covered, then you get more ratings and so forth. But it seems like so early on in the primaries, Gravel and Kucinich on the Democratic side, and particularly Ron Paul and even Tom Tancredo and some of those guys, been just so completely marginalized by the media. That, you know, I think it was Howard Kurtz wrote a thing in the Washington Post after the first couple of debates saying we should get rid of all the dead weight now. And they almost uniformly refused to cover the candidacies of these guys who, you know, Gravel is a retired senator and a pretty successful one back in the day when he was a senator. Paul and Kucinich both in, you know, members of the House of Representatives in good standing, running for President of the United States. And, you know, what do you have to do to get some coverage of these people?
Well, basically, you got to, catch 22 or carrot and chicken of the egg, whatever your analogy. You know, you got to make a run in the polls. I think you have to show the press that, you know, your ideas or your agenda has resonated with enough of voters to be taken seriously. So, you know, for better or for not, I mean, you know, when a field gets too enormous, I mean, it's understandable that the press is going to sort of use, you know, a particular, bar. In this case, it's polling, and it always has been. And it would be nice, though, just to put it to the test if we could see a candidate with one of those, with the same agenda as one of those candidates, really break through, and then we would see if the press, you know, was comfortable covering candidates whose agenda was, you know, not such, you know, considered sort of a rubber stamp mainstream approach.
Yeah.
That would be an interesting test case, because right now, it's hard to argue, you know, that the press isn't given enough to candidates who, you know, are really quite low in the polls. And if they could move those ratings up, then I think they would have a better case in terms of complaining about the lack of coverage.
Right. Yeah, that really is fair. And I guess we'll see, right? It seems to me like a lot of these Republicans are on their way out. And though Paul is not doing all that well in the nationwide polls, he's continuing to rake in the funds, and he's definitely, obviously, he's going to be in the race through the primary season.
Yeah, of those candidates you mentioned, he seems to have struck, you know, the biggest chord. I mean, obviously, it's not on the same scale as any of the major candidates, but his does seem to be the most interesting, and particularly online, he seems to have generated the biggest following and the most passion. So it'll be interesting how, you know, his candidacy progresses.
Yeah, and it'll also be interesting to watch the dissonance on the faces of these news reporters when they do cover him, trying to figure out, I guess Stephen Colbert made the joke out of it, the enigma wrapped in the sesame seed bun of mystery and all that, because they don't know how to deal with somebody who's anti-war and pro-capitalism.
No, you know, right.
So you have these people who, sometimes they ask him, shouldn't he be running as a Democrat, you know, and I don't know. I like that. I like watching their faces twist, you know, and just revealing how little the news anchors really understand about the world compared to some of the people in their audiences, you know?
Yeah, I think the press does prefer candidates to come in nicely wrapped packages, and it makes it easier for them to create a narrative and to sort of describe them in a sort of a shorthand style.
Uh-huh. And, you know, even when they're just doing the banter about, you know, the back and forth about the candidates and, you know, a little bit of Iraq policy and this and that and there, I sometimes get the idea that a lot of these news people, the pundits on the cable news channels, but even the news anchors, I get the idea from their questions a lot of times that they get all their news from TV, too.
Oh,
that they don't read.
So no, I don't know. Well, I'm sure it can be a self-fulfilling, you know, prophecy.
Yeah, I mean, if I got all my news from the radio, this would be the stupidest show in the world. I mean, what would be the point of that?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point. I just don't know. You know, good TV people have staffs and producers that read for them and will, you know, help educate them.
Ah, someday. Wouldn't that be nice?
Yeah, that would be nice.
All right. Well, hey, I really appreciate your time today, everybody. Eric Bollert from Media Matters for America. They're mediamatters.org. Really appreciate your insight today, sir.
Sure thing. Talk to you soon.
All right, folks. This is Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton, and we'll be right back after not too long.
And now he's pulling hits for the Jersey mob. Robert John Smith, you know, he liked just what they taught him. Then he found it like the sight of blood. He sold it all in Africa just for kicks and pay. Got blown to death in Bosnia. But one name that he used to go by when he worked for Air America. Guns for drugs, drugs for guns, and tidy Swiss bank songs. What the people don't know ain't gonna hurt 'em. He learned the ropes and rope just when things got too damn slow. El Salvador, Nicaragua. Turning tricks for the GOP.
This is Anti-War Radio on Chaos 95.9 in Austin, Texas. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Thanks to Eric Bowler for the great interview. Guess what I learned in Time Magazine, y'all? To save the Republic, we need conscription. As the Constitutional Convention of 1787 came to a close, after 3.5 months of deliberation, a lady asked Dr. Franklin, "Well, doctor, what have we got, a republic or a monarchy?" "A republic," replied the doctor, "if you can keep it." Anecdote from the records of the Federal Convention of 1787, editor Max Ferrand, Volume 3, Appendix A, 1911. "A republic, if you can keep it," writes Richard Stengel in Time Magazine. The founders were not at all optimistic about the future of the republic. There had only been a handful of other republics in all of human history, and most were small and far away. The founders' pessimism, though, came not from history, but from their knowledge of human nature. A republic, to survive, needed not only the consent of the governed, but also their active participation. It was not a machine that would go of itself. Free societies do not stay free without the involvement of their citizens. Today, the two central acts of democratic citizenship are voting and paying taxes. That's basically it. The last time we demanded anything else from people was when the draft ended in 1973. That's funny. He doesn't say the last time we demanded anything else from ourselves was when the draft ended in 1973. So I guess Richard Stengel is having trouble keeping track of whether he's one of us or whether he's some ivory tower social elitist who gets to control the rest of us. Yeah, just unfortunate as can be that the government was forced to end the slavery of conscription and had to bring their Indochina war to an end. It's just the biggest shame. Ask George Bush. Why, if that war hadn't ended, everything would be great. And yes, Richard Stengel writes in Time magazine, there are libertarians who believe that government asks too much of us, and that the principal right in a democracy is to be left alone. Oh, that's funny. I thought we were saving the republic here. Now it's the democracy we're saving, I see. But most everyone else bemoans the fact that only about half of us vote. Most everyone bemoans the fact that only half of us vote. I wonder if Richard Stengel has an editor. And don't do much more than send in our tax returns on April 15th. Yes, most of us, most everyone else, most everyone in the country, other than those wacky libertarians who believe that they've lost too much freedom already. But most everyone else bemoans the fact that all they do is pay some substantial portion of their annual income to the IRS once a year and don't vote. Okay. The truth is, even the archetype of the model citizen is mostly a myth. Except for times of war and the colonial days, we haven't been all that energetic about keeping the republic. Oh, you got that right. And why not continue with this? When Americans look around right now, they see a public school system with 38% of fourth graders unable to read at a basic level. They see the cost of health insurance escalating as 47 million people go uninsured. They see a government that responded ineptly to a hurricane in New Orleans. And they see a war whose ends they do not completely value or understand. And this is why we should all have to give up our sons to the state. You understand? Because the same state that hasn't been able to teach fourth graders how to read, the same state that forbid private people from helping each other when a hurricane came and flooded New Orleans, the same state that had built the walls that failed and drowned that city in the first place, the fact that the, frankly, fascist American healthcare system, which is run by basically the Congress of the United States out of Washington, D.C., in collusion with the worst medical corporations and the American Medical Association, etc., the fact that that fascist system has driven up prices so high is the reason that you need to give up your kid to go work for the state. The state that made the prices so high. The state that failed to educate the children. The state that flooded that city, failed to protect it from flooding. And the state that then prevented private people from coming in to help. See, the problem is, if the state was made of people who were forced to be its employees, if only we had national service, then government would be good. See, that's why it's bad. You don't participate in it enough. And if you did, then the government could do more and better. pardon me for being one of those libertarians who thinks that 500 million billion laws is enough. That's not an exaggeration either. I'm pretty sure that's the exact number of laws. 500 million billion. Pardon me if I think that having 7% of the population of this country, well, it's more than that. No, I guess it was 7%. Something like that. Inside the criminal justice system. More than 2 million people in prison. Yeah, pardon me if I think we already have enough government. Pardon me if I think that the best thing the national government could have done for the people of New Orleans is disappear out of their lives. So that private helicopter pilots and private bass fishermen and private Walmart truck drivers and every other description of private people who went there to help and rescue and bring food and water would have been allowed to. Would have been allowed to measure their own risks and consequences. Oh no, Katrina just proves how much more government we need. You know, we just haven't had enough history in this country of cops going door to door seizing people's guns. We need more like that. That was perfectly and completely acceptable when it happened in New Orleans, and in fact, it set a great model for the rest of us. Don't you guys think? Isn't that the lessons that you learned from Hurricane Katrina? Too bad we don't have more government. Too bad that people just aren't civic-minded enough. As though private truck drivers and private bass boat fishermen and private helicopter pilots weren't all racing to New Orleans to do everything they could to help those people. Anyway, I'm tired of reading this article. The guy's got a point. The fact that people don't care nearly as much as they should has consequences. The problem is, what people need to understand when they do that caring and understanding is that if you want to preserve liberty and if you want to preserve the form of a republic, a constitutional representative form of government with a guarantee of protection of individual liberty, then you have to move to limit government. You know, when Benjamin Franklin said a republic, if you can keep it, he was talking about a script. He was talking about a blueprint. They had not yet, not one officer had yet taken power. The Constitution itself had yet to be ratified. The convention had just finished it. And he said, well, we're planning on building a republic if you can keep it. And that blueprint that Franklin and his buddies had drawn up, while I think a vast expansion of power far beyond what was necessary in 1787, describes an absolutely different system than the one we have today. And if this guy, Richard Stengel in Time Magazine, wants to get us back to having a limited republic, well, then he needs to propose that every law passed in the last 100 years be repealed. We've had 100 years straight of building our national government to the point that it now costs more than $3 trillion a year. Just the cost of the national government alone is $3 trillion a year. I'll remind you that Bill Clinton had the first $1 trillion government, and I think that was in 98, toward the end of his presidency. The first $1 trillion budget. Now it's at $3 trillion. Now the Bill of Rights has been undone. Now the president is the commander-in-chief in perpetuity and has unlimited power. Now the Congress is basically a ceremonial rubber stamp for the presidency. Talk about losing your republic. If you want your republic back, you have to vote for congressmen who hate government. You have to vote for congressmen who want to go to D.C. to repeal things. It's to get us back to even the semblance of having a constitutional government in this country. To having actual federalism rather than just the federal government. Which should not even really be called that anymore. It is a national government. It's not a federal one. But anyway, this is Time Magazine's prescription for this. I know how to make, Jimmy and Johnny care about their country. I'll force them to join the army. Or whatever, work at an old folks home or, you know, launch a environmentalist lobbying group. And actually, you know, I don't know if this guy's proposing for this whole thing to be mandatory or not. But I think it's interesting to note when people who put the state first, one gentleman put it on the Lou Rockwell blog, they find themselves envious of private people. They can't stand it when folks just get together on their own accord and go to church together or get together to help clean up some place or, you know, do a big brother's, big sister's, you know, picnic or whatever. They hate that. They can't stand to see people serving each other that it's not under the auspices of the government. After all, the government is us. It's we. Except when it comes down to the whole, force you to work thing, and now you're all you, and I'm different, yeah. If I'm Richard Stengel in Time Magazine, I'm not one of we so much as I might lead you to believe there. It's really easy to switch that off. I'd be interested to know whether Richard Stengel's son is over there serving in Iraq. That's what they call it, right? Serving. This guy who puts such a premium on you serving. And see, here's the other bias in this article. And it's not even said, it's just kind of the unspoken premise. We're all just supposed to understand and accept that if somebody's making money doing their job, performing a service, trading a good, hell, plowing a field. If you're plowing a field for profit, then that's not service. People are sitting down to supper and eating the food that you grew for your own selfish gain, you sick, evil, greedy capitalist. That is the mindset that we're supposed to have. That any transaction that takes place in the private market is only self-interested, profit motive. Bad word. Wash your mouth out. But of course, I don't work for government. I like to think that what I do is a service. People donate to antiwar.com. Some of them attach, hey, yeah, I really like the radio show. So maybe I am providing a service, even though I don't work for government. Maybe people at churches around the country who take care of the sick and the homeless and the needy without being requested or instructed or subsidized by the state to do so on their own time. Hell, even the people who get a tax write-off for donating their canned goods and so forth, providing a service. Hell, being a millionaire's private helicopter pilot to get him to work in the morning is providing a public service. Somebody is being... It's worth it for this guy to fly his private chauffeured helicopter for him so he can get to work fast enough and make more money for more people that makes his helicopter ride worth the price. That guy's got those millions of dollars presumably because he's satisfying people, his customers, his stockholders, etc. Unless, of course, he's got a government contract, in which case that's fascism and that's not okay. But, you know, my point is, well, Walmart sent in fleets of trucks full of bottles of water to go, I mean, you're talking about, you know, 18-wheelers and 16-wheelers and stuff, right? Who could have driven around through flooded New Orleans, passing out bottles of water to stranded people, giving people lifts out of there? No, 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 the government wouldn't let them do it. Those private people. That's not helping if you're a private interest. That's greedy. You're evil. In fact, I was reading on the Lou Rockwell blog, lourockwell.com/blog, I think it is, about how in New Orleans today, the officially licensed and their buddies, the government bureaucrats, are doing everything they can to make it impossible for private people to just go around and in the natural order and figure out where they fit in and can make a buck and rebuild this place. Instead, there are millions and millions and millions of bureaucratic laws and loopholes and new zoning restrictions and God knows what that must be jumped through. And in fact, you know, you're supposed to now like have an official badge that you're allowed to be here and so forth. And yet we'll all do nothing but continue to hear how the government isn't doing enough in New Orleans. When it is so clear that all they have to do is go away and let the people come back and if they feel like it and invest where they want to invest, build where they want to build. Instead, they're, of course, we all know what they're going to do. They're going to wipe out what was the Ninth Ward completely and they're going to turn it all over to giant criminal corporations who are already politically connected with the state. You know that and I know that. But the difference is you will keep saying, I wish government would do more. And I will keep saying, I wish they would just evaporate. You know, get in their private escape pod and fly away to the moon or Mars or somewhere and leave me alone. And see, I'm not even mad. What if I had friends or family or I lived in New Orleans? Boy, would I be pissed. I would be out of my skull. And particularly listening to these people talk about what we need is more government intervention there to rebuild that godforsaken land. I'm sorry, that national government forsaken land. Here, I'm going to put myself in charge of building your wall, but I'm going to do a really lousy job and I'm going to prevent you from doing any improvement to it. And then when it fails, I'm going to keep you from your property, I'm going to seize your guns, and I'm going to not let you come back, open a business, rebuild your house. I'm going to do everything I can to thwart you because I'm a bureaucrat. I'm Uncle Sam, and I'm here to help. That's the way it goes. No, but what we really need is national service. What we really need is for you and you and you to turn over your kids to the state. Because otherwise, what good would they do anybody? Who would ever go visit old people at the hospital if the state wasn't doing it? Who would ever take care of a bum and let him crash on the couch if the state wasn't subsidizing it? Who would ever get together to stop a war if it wasn't the government-funded and created foundations? Okay, I'm sorry. I'm just ranting and raving now. What I should do is pull up the volume on the phone here, because I have... my friend, I think. Pretty sure, yeah. My friend, Vineyard Saker. He's a co-blogger of mine over at thestressblog.com. He has his own blog. It's vineyardsaker.blogspot.com. And yeah, we got some things to go over here. Welcome back to the show, VS.
Hey, thanks. Good to be with you.
Yeah, it's good to have you on here. I got a few things to talk with you about. When Gareth Porter was on the show last week, we talked about how the Israeli government was really pushing for a war against Iran immediately after September 11th, and how basically Bush, Cheney, Wolfowitz, the neocon cabal wanted Iraq first, and how the Israelis basically got on board and helped push us into the war in Iraq. But what they really wanted all along was war against Iran. And you made the comment on the blog there that, hey, no way, don't let the Israelis out of this, that, you know, they were very responsible for the American war in Iraq and so forth. And I was just wondering whether you saw the cover article, the spotlight today on antiwar.com. It's a Huffington Post entry by David Bromwich. Did you see that?
No, I haven't.
Okay, it's called Iraq, Israel, Iran. And it's a review of the new book, The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy by John Mearsheimer and Stephen Walt, authors.
Yeah, I'm reading it right now.
The famous. Oh, are you? I haven't gotten the book yet, but authors of the famous article by that name, very controversial article by that name. And anyway, according to David Bromwich, this is basically the story that that Mearsheimer and Walt tell as well. That the Sharon government said, "Hey, Iran, hit Iran," and that when it became clear that the Bush crew wanted to go to Iraq first, that it was then that the Israeli government got in line and caught up with the neocons and began helping to lie us into war in Iraq. Is that what you're getting from the book there?
Well, to tell you the truth, I have no way of knowing. I still haven't decided, you know, whether Jerusalem runs the U.S. or Washington runs Jerusalem and Israel, and where the real center of decision-making is. I mean, it's pretty clear to me that these guys are working together. But, you know, the comparative influence of American neocons versus Israeli Likudniks is just really hard to establish. I mean, it's plausible.
Yeah.
Sure it is. What's not plausible is saying, like others do, you know, that Israelis were opposed and were warning the U.S. about Saddam Hussein. Clearly, after September 11th, they had a perfect reason to use the, you know, flag-waving anger in this country to try to get, you know, something gone. They started with Afghanistan, which was the obvious one, at least from their point of view, and went for the next one, having somebody in power like Saddam Hussein. And clearly he was not that hard to attack. And keep in mind, attacking him also got the oil lobby on board and everybody else.
Right.
Iran, who really wants it? I mean, I know you mentioned Lockheed a couple of times. You know, maybe, maybe not, but even if Lockheed is behind that, that's still a pretty small player compared to, you know, the lobby.
Right.
Pushing
well,
for it. So I guess they took what they could.
Well, do you think that the military-industrial complex is a small player compared to the lobby? I guess Andrew Coburn, when I interviewed him, he said, well, this is how he defines the neoconservatives. They are the combination of the military-industrial complex lobbyists and the Israel lobby. They're the amalgam. They figured that the neocons, when they moved from the left to the right, they needed some new allies. So they teamed up with the Christian right crazies and with Lockheed in them.
Yeah, and one of your guests mentioned the oil, though. What is it? Oil, Israel, and logistics approach.
Right.
It's not. Mearsheimer and Walter are doing a good thing explaining that the lobby is not a monolithic organization. It's not, doesn't have, you know, a central commander and secret handshakes. But the military-industrial complex is partially enmeshed with the lobby and everything else. So I don't think it speaks as clearly as it's not as monothematic as the lobby is. So they will be working together. As they had in 91, by the way, for the first war against Saddam Hussein over Kuwait. But I don't think that this is the military-industrial complex is something that can be, you know, opposed to the lobby. I would say that what I call in my blog, you know, the old Anglo Guard, which is more the oil people, are way more powerful. And they have been opposing the lobby with extreme energy. I mean, the Walt Mearsheimer, just an example. You have Jimmy Carter, you have Michael Scheuer, you have many other people who are, you know, very much of the old Anglo / CIA / oil elite, who now are leaking like crazy, writing books against it, for the first time raising the issue of the lobby. I would identify the major opponent of the lobby in the U.S. less as a military-industrial complex and more as what I call the old Anglo Guard.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I talked to Wayne White last week, and he was on the Baker Commission, the Baker Study Group, and I asked him about all this fighting going on between, and it's been going on, too, the battle over the surge between Edward, I'm going to say is wrong, Djerian, and Frederick Kagan and the guys over at AEI. And I have to tell you, Well, here's where it all comes down to. This is the way Greg Palast has it in his book, too. He's got this chart that has, here's the neocon side, and here's the James Baker side, and here they are fighting against each other, and here are their different plans, and their different alliances with different Iraqis, and all this different stuff. But at the top of the chain of both commands is Dick Cheney. I mean, his, you know, James Baker is Dick Cheney's lawyer. Baker Botts represents Halliburton. And
yet,
on the other hand, it's Cheney who's been the one to go along with all these neocons all along.
But again, you're thinking in terms of chain of command. I don't think there is such a supreme commander of anything, either in the lobby or in the Anglo group, for that matter. I mean, people also have their own careers, their own opportunities, their own struggles for power. Cheney and Rumsfeld hated each other, but they still work together. You know, I mean, it's not like they're simple. And I would like to stress here something. You know, I sound kind of racist when I pit Anglos versus Jews, to put it directly here. But I used to work in a past distant life for a think tank, a very conservative think tank inside the Beltway. And being myself from Europe, you know, after a while working there, the director of that think tank actually told me with hushed tones, once he had figured out that, you know, I was not an American, you know, those Jews, they're actually, you know, taking over. And he gave me many examples of, in conservative institute, he mentioned specifically the Heritage Foundation, that initially had much more of a Anglo-Christian slant, who turned rabidly pro-IPAC, etc. I heard that from several people in the Anglo group who certainly identify Jews by their nationality. So it's not endorsing that kind of separation. I think it's nonsense to say that all Anglos or all Jews in the U.S. think the same thing. But I think those two groups identify each other in exactly those terms, that they know that there's the Anglos on one side, the old guard, and the new guard is Jewish.
Yeah. Well, and of course, it's an important point to say, and as you mentioned, this doesn't mean all Jews or all Anglos anything. We're talking about two different factions in D.C. and New York fighting over power, and, well, one of them
and
is what they
always call
them.
And both factions, I believe, identify the, quote, opponent or temporary ally in ethnic terms. I mean, that's what I saw when I was working in Washington. That was in the late 80s. I saw it with my eyes. And me being neither Jewish or Anglo, it was kind of amusing for me to see how in the supposedly melting pot of the USA, people identified each other very much in ethnic terms.
Yeah. Well, and there is some of that. In fact, I'm kind of ignorant on this history. I wish Angela Keaton was here. I know she could explain it a lot better, but she just told me the story one time about, because she knows all the history of the libertarian movement going all the way back and everything, was raised that way.
Mm-hmm.
And so she knows this whole history of all the different magazines, right? All the different fighting in the magazines, the National Review this and Commentary that, and all that going back decades and decades. And for her, that's how she kind of explained it. Really was the old establishment was the Anglo-American establishment, you know, like Carol Quigley called it, what we used to call the Eastern liberal establishment or whatever.
Sure.
Here. And the libertarian and neoconservative movements were basically made up of Catholics and Jews.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not particularly a Jewish thing as much as it is, well, there's a lot of Catholics involved in the neoconservative movement. And of course, the libertarian movement has been led by Catholics and Jews all along too.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, for a time in the 70s, there were a lot of alliances here against the socialist left between the libertarians and the neocons and so forth. And so I think you're right that this does have a lot of, you know, we used to be the second tier, but now we're moving up, and how do you like that kind of attitude?
Yeah.
And personally, I kind of like that. I remember when I was a kid hearing about a country club in Houston where no Jews were allowed, so the Jews bought it. So how do you like that? And I think that's hilarious, you know? That's how.
Yeah, and I'm sure you remember the comments about the crazy downstairs, which was the White House way among Anglos of speaking of the Jews around, you know, Wolfowitz and the rest of the crowd. I mean, they really dislike each other.
Right.
I think these guys have very deep racist feelings, actually.
Well, and you look,
but when needed, you know, they will switch sides or, you know, work for either side as Cheney did, and they will work together towards a common goal. So when it's clear, like the 91 war, or still pretty clear, like the second war against Saddam Hussein, you know, they work together in perfect concert, and not a single Mersheimer, Walt, Carter, Scheuer, anybody else said a single word about any kind of lobby in the U.S. Now suddenly that only one lobby is really interested in a war with Iran, suddenly the Anglos, they also got purged from the CIA and a lot of other places like the Pentagon, now they're fighting back because they're losing power and they're really mad.
Yeah. And you know, to be even more clear about this, because I hate the even the idea that, you know, either of us would be accused of anti-Semitism here. Or
well, we will
you.
Anyway. So.
You know, whatever. People can say what they want, but, you know, the fact of the matter is, all the best anti-neocons... Well, first of all, who's been convicted of spying for Israel? Larry Franklin, a Catholic. You know, and some of the most despicable of the neocons have been Catholics, not Jews. You know, it's an ideology we're talking about.
Yeah, here. Sure.
And of course, on the other side of that, who are the best reporters in America covering this story? Seymour Hersh and Jim Loeb and Robert Dreyfus and
Amy Goodman and Greg Palast, of course.
Yeah, sure. Eric Garris runs antiwar.com. So
no doubt.
So please don't anybody get us all wrong here, what we're talking about. But see, this is the thing. This is the I want to be a fly on the wall when Dick Cheney and David Rockefeller have lunch, but I can't be. And so, but I like to wonder about these things, and I like to try to measure as best I can from the outside looking in, you know, who's who in the establishment and what they're about. And, you know, I think Wayne White was very honest last week in saying, listen, it's not even just the Israel lobby. It's, you could say it's the Israel lobby, but that goes back 50 years to the point where now Americans in super majorities overwhelmingly support Israel and are willing to go along with Israeli policy. I mean, the polls show it too. Are you in favor of war with Iran? No. Are you in favor of war with Iran if George Bush says it's necessary? Well, yeah, the numbers go up. Are you in favor of war with Iran if they're a threat to Israel? Oh, absolutely. And the numbers go up even further. So,
as Finkelstein, Norman Finkelstein, said on the Doha debate, you can find that on YouTube online or Google video, you would then have to ask the question why it is that the Americans think that. And if you look where they get their information and the rapidly neocon corporate press in this country, I mean, that's not surprising. It's like saying, you know, that Germans like to goose-step down the street. Sure, they do that because the propaganda pushes them towards that. But it's precisely by stifling open debate, by not allowing anybody to raise these issues, that they achieve that.
Right. And to get back to the facts of the case, there's no other group of people in this country pushing. Now, there are a lot of people, I guess, who are willing to be, you know, pushed and pulled along. There's no other real group pushing for war with Iran other than the Israel lobby. And it's a war with Iran that, as we've covered on this show over and over and over again, that will be an absolute and total disaster for the United States, presumably for Israel, too. I can't see how a war with Iran could possibly benefit Israel at this point or any other. But this is, and never mind that. This is absolutely against the interests of the United States of America. And to have a foreign country's lobby pushing our country into another war in the Middle East is absolutely, you know, give me a good word. It's not okay. It must be stopped.
Well, and you're quite right in pointing out something which is really overlooked, is that the lobby has really hurt Israel. And if they continue having that kind of power in the country, and if, God forbid, a war with Iran starts, it's going to hurt Israel really bad. Because I don't believe that the U.S. can actually achieve an outcome which would be desirable to the U.S. at all. I think it would be at major risk for very serious consequences. And if the United States really gets hurt there, then there will be a huge raising of the issue of the lobby. And, you know, Israel will be blamed as a country. The region will have a very influential, victorious Shia regime both in Iran and in Iraq. If I were Israeli, I would oppose the lobby with everything I have. And a lot of Israelis actually do oppose it. They have the same problem as Americans in this country. They have a difficulty to put their message out. They're called self-hating Jews, etc. But it's happening. Increasingly, it is happening.
Well, and the thing is, I think a reasonable person on a sunny afternoon, if you asked him, would agree that the best policy probably for Israel would be to try to shake hands and work out agreements with their neighboring countries and populations and you know, try to make friends. Tell them, look, we're not going away, but we don't have to always be at each other's throats. Let's work this out. That's the clear policy if you want Israel to exist and be safe in the long term. Otherwise, you'd have to adopt this insane idea, which I don't think any reasonable person on a sunny afternoon would think is the proper policy, which is smash them all and dominate them militarily forever.
Well, we'll keep in mind that the Israelis are even more frightened than Americans, though. They're frightened by suicide bombers. They're frightened by Qassam rockets. They're frightened by what they perceive as hard-to-stop, if not invincible, Hezbollah fighters. And they're absolutely terrified of a nuclear Iran. And most of them do not know that Iran has no nuclear weapon program. They do sincerely believe that, you know, Ahmadinejad can press the button and it's going to happen. And even furthermore, most of them have never been exposed to the idea that a nuclear-armed Iran would not be a danger to Israel. That's, I mean, some people raise the issue gradually. I read the Israeli press fairly often, and it's starting to come out. But mostly you have a terrified public. And they have a sense, you know, it's everybody against us. We're in a region where we're not loved. And that's true. No doubt here. And, you know, what's the solution? And the thought of giving up, well, they already have given up, you know, the myth of the invincible Israeli army. They got really kicked by 1,000 Hezbollah fighter tops against, you know, several Israeli divisions. So the last thing they can latch onto is a nuclear-armed Israel and everybody else on having nuclear weapons. And a terrified public will want to maintain that.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, I think you make a good point that even if Iran did have nukes, what are they going to do? Themselves nuked? I mean, Israel could wipe Persia off the face of the map in an instant.
Well, not an instant and not all of it, but it could hurt them definitely.
I mean, they got 400-something hydrogen bombs, last I heard.
Yeah, but you need to deliver them. I mean, Iran is a big country. They couldn't just, you know, wipe them all off the map, but they could really, really impose huge damage on it. There's no doubt about that. And besides, I really don't think the Iranians have any intention of either acquiring or actually, much less so, ever using it. What they would like, definitely, if they had a nuclear weapon, is to prevent a U.S. attack. So somewhere, if the party that pushes Iran towards a nuclear weapon program more than anybody else are the neocons. If the Iranians had the same comfort as the, you know, North Koreans had, they would not be facing an attack by the U.S. So that's a powerful argument in favor of having a nuclear weapon.
Well, and that goes to the larger point of how counterproductive all of neoconservative policy seems to be. I think the first time I ever spoke with Chalmers Johnson, he talked about how during the Cold War, and when policymakers had a bit more sane approach, their biggest fear was a Paris-Berlin-Moscow axis, and or Beijing as well. And he said, that's exactly what we're creating now.
Yes.
We're now, by claiming benevolent global hegemony, no one will ever oppose us, no peer will ever rise up to anywhere near our status ever again, and we're going to rule every country and every continent and every economy, and nobody's going to stand in our way. All that's doing is pushing the only people who actually can be competitors to the United States into each other's arms.
Well, not only that, but there's another axis which is gradually developing and largely unnoticed, is Iran and Pakistan, which are getting closer and closer and closer. They're even discussing security ties. Now, mostly of that is border security. But still, those two countries have been closing up to each other very much. And Pakistan, I would think, is the real threat for the entire region. I mean, I think it's one of the most dangerous countries out there because it's filled with Al-Qaeda types, or Taliban types would be probably more accurate, and it has nuclear weapons already, including delivery systems.
Right.
So I would worry about Pakistan long before I would worry about Iran.
Well, tell me about Russia's relationship with Iran. I have to tell you, if I was like some sneaky KGB guy in a shadow somewhere, I would probably be trying to encourage the Iranians to behave in ways which will overextend America more and more. And I probably would even be willing to sacrifice Iran and push them into full-scale conflict if I thought that over the long term what it would do is bring America to its knees. And I wonder, you know, whether you have any speculation at all behind or about Russia's relationship, or, well, obviously facts first and speculation second, about Russia's relationship with Iran.
Yeah, I had the opportunity to spend a lot of time actually dealing with Russia and its security establishment. The relationship is very interesting. First of all, I have to realize that Russia is a monolith. There are several groups, shall I say, schools of thought inside the country. by and large, right now, Russia is what I call a thugocracy, which is basically a mix of mafia and ex-KGB people, or mafia inside the new KGB, etc.
Mm-hmm.
They are led pretty strongly by Putin, who controls that fairly well. But some agencies have a lot of leeway. For instance, Russian intelligence services, and particularly the military, I know for a fact, has sympathies with Iran. So on one hand, you would have to find people, the economic people, for instance, who are building the plant at Buxar in Iran, who are at times having tensions with Iranians over payments. But at the same time, I know for a fact that the Russian military intelligence has a huge interest and admiration for Iran. First of all, because they consider them as very interesting partners. There have been quiet exchanges between both security establishments. The Russians came back very impressed. I spoke to several of them who said, you know, you wouldn't believe the analytical centers these guys have and their how you know, educated their analysts are. They came very, very impressed by their Iranian counterparts. They also like them because they're anti-American, they're patriotic, and they're religious, which has more and more appeal in Russia today. So they feel common interests. They certainly know it's a good market for weapons. And I think they would support Iran, and that's why I think that's everything that the military intelligence, or actually the civilian intelligence service, the external one in Russia, can get about U.S. preparations, I'm fairly sure is passed directly onto the Iranian leadership, as was the case, by the way, with Saddam Hussein before the war in 91. I think the Russians would probably not, as a country, push the United States towards war with Iran. I don't think that would be Putin's policy. It's just too dangerous to do that. But do I think that there are people inside the Russian security establishment who will, on one hand, push the Americans, on the other hand, prepare the Iranians, help them with everything they can, and hope that the Americans, you know, really get overextended and bog down? Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's been the history of the past, I guess, 30, 40 years that the Americans and the Russians take turns trying to give each other another Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
Right?
Very much so. But I would not want to make it sound like Iran would be a junior partner in that. I mean, the Iranians are completely independent, but they've been very careful. For instance, look at Chechnya. The Iranians have never supported the Chechen separatists, unlike other Muslim countries. They did send fighters, and they did support the Bosnian Muslims in Kosovo, but that they considered fair. So they're not allied to Russia, but they are not going to ever antagonize Russia too openly, and they have not done so. If you look at the way they refer to the Chechens, they never refer as resistance, but they say that, the, you know, the guerrillas or the insurgency. So there is a quiet and very close relationship between the security establishments of both countries.
And now, what do you think about all these assassinations and so forth? The journalist and the former intelligence guy who've been whacked, I guess. Putin got the blame pretty much for all those things. Do you agree with that?
No. And I dislike Putin intensively. I very much dislike what he represents, which is a return to the Soviet, you know, bad old days, as far as I'm concerned. But in the case of Politkovskaya, the journalist, actually people were arrested for her murder very recently. I think it was last week. Concerning the former intelligence agent, he was involved in all sorts of shady dealings, and I just don't see the successor to the KGB, which today is called the SVR, botching in such a ridiculous way, you know, an assassination. Russia today has at least two units fully dedicated to external assassinations. None of them would botch the way they did. And I frankly think that a lot of that can be explained more by mafia links and Chechen mafia links specifically. And it's used then by the British, for instance, and other Western countries to, you know, give Russia a hard time politically. So I want to insist, I very much think Putin is capable of killing people, and, you know, they are, as I said, thugs and former KGB people, but I think most of those assassinations are not the hands of the Russian intelligence services.
And what do you make of the recent renewal of Russian bomber flights?
Nothing much, really. I mean, it's part of courtesy of the neocons. The price of oil has been high. Russia has more money. And Putin is clearly trying to reestablish a military, not the former military power of the Soviet Union, but at least to reestablish some how shall I call it, mid-level, solid military power for Russia. And that includes many things. It includes much more, many more exercises, joint exercises abroad, and includes strengthening Airborne Brigade, Special Operations Brigade, and includes strengthening the Air Force, procuring new equipment, etc. And part of that is simply reestablishing patrols. But nobody in Russia is seriously planning for a nuclear war with bombers against the West. So it's just more a show of the flag and a reestablishment of capabilities than any kind of threat or message.
More about pleasing the domestic audience in Russia, you think?
Yeah, sure. Mm-hmm. Besides, the real threat for the U.S., if it were, or, you know, the West, doesn't come from Russian bombers. The real threat would be from mobile land-based missiles.
Mm-hmm.
And those have been also growing, by the way. So Putin has been expanding over the past years, gradually, I would say, and slowly. It's nothing like it was in the Soviet times, but has been expanding military expenditures and training.
Now, how do you think Russia would respond in the event of Dick Cheney unleashing the Air Force against Iran? I know, well, I guess maybe this is dated information, but at least there used to be a bunch of Russian scientists at the Bushehr reactor. Are we in danger of bombing some Russians in Iran? And what do you think that Putin would do?
Well, precious nothing. They're going to bitch and yell in the Security Council and, you know, express outrage and stuff like this. But keep in mind, they're realists. They know they can't start a war over that. They have absolutely no desire to start a war over this. Look how they betrayed Serbia for all their grand promises of helping, you know, the Orthodox Slavic Serbs. They completely betrayed them. They're bribable. Remember, it's mafia people. Many years ago in the 80s, I once interviewed a fairly high-ranking defector from the then Soviet Union, and he one of the things he commented to me was, you know, the Americans are wrong to send diplomats to speak with the Soviet diplomats. They should send the Chicago chief of police. And I took this comment to mean, you know, that somebody tougher and the diplomats are too liberal. Whereas what he really meant, and understood only later, is that culturally, a U.S. sheriff would understand, somebody who deals with the local mob, would understand the mentality of the Russians much better.
Mm.
They're way closer to Pablo Escobar or, you know, some Cali cartel or the, you know, Don Corleone in the Godfather, and they are of some communist, nationalist, religious, orthodox. They're none of that. They're essentially mafia kind of people with the same kind of mythology around them. And they will just, you know, when they see that it's too late for Iran and the war has started, they will help very quietly. Individual agencies or group of people will help the Iranians with what they can. They will politically exploit it to the maximum. They'll hope for the worst for the U.S., but they will not get involved directly. Absolutely not. There's no risk of third world war over the Middle East. I don't buy that for one sec.
Yeah. Well, that's good to know. I mean, I guess that's what I would have assumed, too, that, you know, Iran is Iran, but it's not worth a world war over.
You know, I don't think they would do it even if the U.S. landed in southern Russia, or in southern Russia, maybe. But, you know, even look at the expansion of NATO. They did nothing. They huffed and puffed and protested it. But
right.
They did nothing, not against Estonia, Latvia, nobody. They're not going to get into. They don't want a foreign military adventure.
Now, let's redirect back here to the Middle East, and specifically the redirection back toward America's traditional allies, Jordan, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, the Sunni so-called
mm-hmm.
moderates, the dictatorships that are loyal to the United States. I think you posted up in some comments on the blog during the show last week that this is far too little too late. There's basically no Sunni resistance worthwhile left to ally with.
Oh, yeah, sure. Because keep in mind that Iraq is not a centralized country. The big place, Baghdad, is completely Shia-controlled. Dar Jamal, I think, the other week was wrote a piece where he was interviewed, I'm not sure, when he said that, you know, most people in Iran are Shia, most refugees are Sunni. I mean, that tells the story. And sure, there is a Sunni insurgency, and it's possible to try to ally the U.S. with them. I don't think it's going to tip the balance for one second. It's just absolutely way too late. That had to be done when Saddam Hussein was in power, propped up by a lot of money. You know, the Mukhabarat, the secret service who could torture, kill, and, you know, disappear entire villages. Then it was still doable to repress them. Now it's too late. I mean, the Shias are out of the box, and nobody's going to put them back in. And I don't even think that the Sunnis would ever agree to make good allies for the U.S. because they have the U.S. to blame for everything bad that happened to them.
Mm-hmm.
So they're going to butcher Americans at the first opportunity. Now, if they can get weapons from them, if they can, you know, strengthen their fiefdoms for a while, they'll do it. But still, this is not something, you know, that's not at all a strategy for protecting American troops. Keep also in mind that there are no battle lines, you know, or clearly cut zones in Iran today. So if, for instance, take the American accusation that the Al-Quds force entered Basra disguised as an American private contract with SUVs, etc., and then kidnapped a bunch of soldiers and killed them, well, if they say that's true, I don't believe it is, but if it say it is true, how hard would it be for the Shia to strike Americans anywhere in the Anbar province, in Kurdistan? They could do it with no problem.
Mm-hmm. You're talking about the kidnapping and executions in Karbala, right?
Karbala, yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Correct.
Yeah.
So I don't think that's a viable strategy. I think, again, it's too little, too late, and I think the neocons are extremely reactive. They don't have a long-term plan. They kid themselves, they're delusional, and now that's just another typical, you know, hope for them. Let's see if that works. That's because they don't understand the country and the region at all.
Well, you know, the headlines yesterday was Bush caught. He tried to deny it, but oops, it's here's the proof that he was informed of Paul Bremer's decision to completely and totally disband not just the Iraqi army, but the entire Baathist government down to the local janitors at the elementary schools and everybody else. And I guess he thought he was going to get away with saying that the buck stopped lower on the chain. But no, there's the letter to the president all about it and his response back and so forth. And one of the comments, the president, or the, I guess it was his press secretary or somebody, had said that he couldn't remember why it was that they fired the Iraqi army, why it was that they got rid of the Baathist government. And I just thought, you know, maybe because I know the president listens to the show every day, maybe I could remind him that it was because the Shia said so. And because if he did not do what Ayatollah Sistani said and abolish the Baathist government down to every last detail, then Sistani was basically promising a widespread Shia resistance against the occupation. They were going to have to start the war all over again. And so
In all fairness to Dabia, and I usually don't defend him, what option did he have? I mean, the Americans had nothing like we would have needed to oppose Sistani and the majority. That's why they had to accept direct elections.
Yeah,
they
exactly.
only had the will to fight the little guy on the block, which was the, you know, the Sunni, and the Baathist Sunni even is more limited. And they thought they could get away with that, and it's a knee-jerk reaction.
Yep, and in fact, Glenn Greenwald had this great piece about the dishonesty of the neocons, as they are now saying, oh, well, you know, obviously the big purple-fingered election was a terrible mistake, and we just helped the Iranians win and so forth. You know, in the summer of 2007, they're saying that the very same people who said that all the rest of us had to shut up because of how wonderful the purple-fingered election was back in 05.
Yeah, and the same thing, the wonderful election of Hamas, which was democratic and everything, the State Department wanted for the new Middle East. And it didn't work either. Or the revolution, the Cedar Revolution in Lebanon, which was also so wonderful. And they're about to have a presidential election, which is going to be just as wonderful. Of course, they just constantly screw up this by doing the same thing, by being completely inept, poorly informed. They don't know what they're doing, really.
So I guess what they're thinking now, I mean, close as I can tell, they figured that since they've given Iraq to Iran, or at least to the Shia majority, that the people with the political power and so forth, the Supreme Islamic Council and so forth, are so close to Iran that basically they just need to have a regime change in Iran. And then it'll be okay that Iran is so close with the guys in Iraq.
Sure. And they also blamed Iran for Lebanon last year, and they even blamed Iran for Hamas being in Gaza. Of course. And if that doesn't work, what do they have to lose? I mean, always keep that in mind. I know how insane that kind of thinking sounds to a normal person, but Olmert and Bush have absolutely nothing to lose.
They have completely painted themselves into a corner, really.
Yeah. Yeah, what can they do? You know, withdraw in an orderly way and say, oops, that's not going to fly.
Wow. So, let's see, I guess it was about... It was really 2005, I guess, was when Khalilzad was pushing to rehire the Baathists and kind of redirect toward the Sunni Arabs. Could it have even worked then?
I don't know. I really don't know. It's hard to do.
I mean, because even then, in 2005, those of us who were looking at prospects for war with Iran were saying, yeah, do what Khalilzad says. At least if you're going to occupy this place forever, you know, at least get on, you know, in the Sunni provinces and so forth and try to find some new supply lines that don't run through Shia territory, because otherwise, It's the same dead horse I beat up here every day. If America bombs Iran while our guys are surrounded by Shia Arabs in the south of Iraq, they're dead meat.
Well, there's no really other supply lines to talk about. So that's out. By road and by sea, you have to go through Shia territory. Syria is not going to be exactly the ideal, you know, rear base for pre-positioning equipment. They made many mistakes. When they got in, Baghdad was still a mixed city. Now it's a fairly ethnically cleansed one. That's not possible to reverse. They allowed the Badr Brigade to come in, which was an organized, well-trained force, and, you know, become the police and the government. That was a huge mistake. They made, single-handedly made Muqtada al-Sadr famous by shutting down his newspaper, trying to arrest him, pinning a charge of, stupid charge of assassination on him, and then fighting two battles against him. I mean, every single step that they made strengthened the Shia. And I would say in 2005, you said, if that's what you're referring to, I think it would be already too late. By then, I would say you cannot get the Shia right back. If they had come in and immediately aligned themselves with some kind of strongman, Saddam Hussein, maybe that would have been an option. But even that, I doubt. But now the Shia own the country and the Iranians are right behind them.
And, now,
and the Saudis have nothing to offer besides money and Al-Qaeda, which is really a small force in there.
It appears to me that the trial balloon's about trying to overthrow Maliki and replace him with Iyad Alawi has kind of already run its course. What do you think?
Oh, that's nonsense. They're the same thing as Karzai in Afghanistan. They're just, you know, the mayor of the Green Zone. At least Karzai is considered the mayor of Kabul. They're just the mayors of the Green Zone. It's completely irrelevant. I mean, it's more of a psychotherapy exercise than anything else.
Well, so
it has no impact on the crucial regions. The Brits just handed over the south to the Shia. Anbar, there's a very good piece by Juan Cole called How Al-Anbar Isn't What's Safe and How It is calm, is artificially produced. I have it on my blog, and it's on his blog, too. Even Anbar is not in good shape, and nothing they will do with anybody in the Green Zone will make any difference.
Yeah, you know, Bush's big surprise PR visit there was way out in a base in the absolute middle of nowhere out in the desert.
It actually was hilarious that he went there and, you know, posted nice photographs with the troops, and it's pathetic.
Yeah, and, you know, of course, that's the next talking point, too, right, is that, well, if we leave, Al-Qaeda will take over Al-Anbar province. How much truth is there to that, do you think?
Zero. They're too small. They're way too small to take control of anything over in Iraq. That's nonsense.
Well, but the president says that they're going to establish a base there and then create an Osama bin Laden caliphate from Spain to Indonesia. Who could stop them if not us?
Well, us is the only people that can only help them towards that goal and, you know, and not stop them. Who could stop them? I would tell you, Iran and the Shia are the single strongest force against Al-Qaeda today. And that's true in Lebanon, and that's true in Iraq. They are strong, organized. They have by far the best intelligence service and military in the Middle East. They are the natural ally in a war against Al-Qaeda, but that's just not acceptable to the neocons.
Well, and they've said that openly, haven't they, the Al-Qaeda types, that we want to try to foment war between the United States and Iran.
Yeah, of course. That makes sense, because that's their biggest threat. There's no Al-Qaeda in Basra or Karbala, and for good reason. And nothing much of Al-Qaeda in Iran either. I mean, not that they haven't been trying, but they are mortal enemies. And that would be a powerful ally, but there's no alliance happening with Iran as long as the neocons are in power in the U.S.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, we wouldn't have to be best friends forever, you know. We could just, you know, cease with all the hostile intention all the time, all the saber rattling. And again,
well, I would notice that Iran did not do much saber rattling against the U.S.
Oh, no,
so
no.
It's a
I'm
one-way
talking
saber
about
rattling.
The Americans.
Yeah. Oh, I agreed.
Yeah.
I agree, and get some kind of, and Iran offered a deal even on Israel. I mean, they're also realists. They know exactly well that they're not going to throw the U.S. out of the Middle East or, you know, wipe Israel off the map. They never had that intention anyways. But their main concern have always been the Wahhabi Salafi types in Afghanistan through the Talibans, Al-Qaeda, and the Ba'athists. Now the Ba'athists are gone, and the last thing they want is a Sunni Wahhabi kind of force in Iraq, and that's what they're going to fight.
Well, it's been reported that they have Al-Qaeda guys in prison there in Iran, including even Osama bin Laden's son.
Yeah, I heard that. I wonder what, you know, what the charges for for holding him is. I mean, just because his dad is Osama, or is there something else behind it? But yeah, I've heard that too.
I think probably they're just holding him. I don't know whether they, you know, have any actual law they're applying to him or not. They're probably just holding him because they don't want to be the country that ever let him go.
Well, and they have a long, long-standing hatred for the Wahhabis. I mean, they always consider the Taliban, and the Chechens, I would add, as being really non-Muslims, as a bunch of barbarians. If you look at the role, for instance, Saudi Arabia or the Taliban or even the Chechen leaders want for women, and, you know, most of the parliament, I think, in Iran is now composed of women. They're in politics. They're in all positions. They're on TV. They have a completely different view of Islam, and they're mutually exclusive. So they really hate the Wahhabis. And it's a long story of hatred between the Wahhabis and the Iranian Shia.
Yeah, but Eli Lake at the New York Sun would say that you're just being naive, that they're all Muslims, and they might be different from each other, but they have more in common with each other than they do with us, and that they surely would work together against us if they thought they wanted to or needed to.
Yeah, they might. I would agree with that. But considering the case of the Wahhabi, I think it's the worst threat. And I think Iran would gladly cooperate with the U.S. against them. That doesn't mean that Shia and Sunnis would always oppose each other. Not at all.
Yeah,
I mean, there even has been a ruler by the Cairo. Hello?
Yeah, I'm just saying, what you're saying is we just need to stop creating the circumstances where they might let bygones be bygones.
Yes, and just use objective, community of interest when it's available. I'm not saying, becoming Iran over here. Or making them, NATO members or close allies. I'm just saying sometimes countries that we have a bone with have common interests with us that we can exploit.
Yep. And, of course, anybody can go and do a Google search and find the Iranian peace offer of 2003 where they put everything on the table from their support for Hezbollah and Hamas to the nuclear program and relations with Israel and everything else.
Yeah, or take the example of what happened in Lebanon where the Christian General Aoun became a close ally to Hezbollah. And he's a Christian, and he was not at all pro-Muslim at all, and he was a big opponent of Syria. And now these guys are in a common political bloc.
Yeah, well, there you have it. All right, we're all out of time. Thanks very much for your insight today. Everybody, Vineyard Saker, you can read what he writes at vineyardsaker.blogspot.com or check him out over at thestressblog.com, too. Thanks a lot, man.
Sure, bye-bye, and have a great day.
Well,